Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Fireside Room, Ingrid Christiansen will be speaking on feminist stories, our heritage, and daughters. So let's listen in on Ingrid.
I'm going to start by recounting to you a little coffee break conversation that I was having about Bible study with Fred Niedner, who was teaching Bible study. If any of you were there, you know that we, in Bible study, looked at a series of stories about betrothals that happened at wells in the Bible. And we talked at great length about the symbolism of them, and Fred is wonderful and really knows a lot and just sent shivers down my spine a number of times because of the things he taught us and brought together for us. But one of the things we did not talk about in that Bible study is how all those women felt about being given away by their fathers to strange men from other places that they then went off with. And the kind of powerlessness of those women. One of the women got to say whether or not she would go. And who was that?
Rebecca,
yes. And Rebecca's name, he told us, means noose. She caught this guy. It can mean affectionate or sweet catching as well as charming, yes. But anyhow, it struck me that we just don't hear these stories about a lot of situations like this in the Bible from the point of view of the women. And I, you know, my gut goes, good heavens, I don't want to give up that kind of power to my father, to have him tell me after he's met some guy for less than 24 hours who's from a completely different county, at least, maybe country, that I should go off with him and marry him and have a life. It makes me very nervous. And I know that those were different times and that women had different expectations for their lives. But it is interesting to me that the story I read day before yesterday implies the same kind of connection. And that story connected with the Bible study that Fred did day before yesterday, so I'm starting to feel like we're sort of doing this thing. And then the story that I'm going to read today is from the 19th century, and it implies the same kind of role for women. And you could still say, well, okay, 20 centuries ago women had that role, and one century ago women had that role, except that I promise you, not read a newspaper since I got to Holden Village a week ago, but this morning my hostess, where I'm staying, Janet Grant, happened to have this newspaper sitting out from this week, not a century ago. And the front page of the Star Tribune, Minneapolis Star Tribune, has a story dated Friday, June 16th, which begins, the headline is, Lutheran Synod ousts West St. Paul Church over gender role doctrine. So, of course, I was interested. A Lutheran church in West St. Paul has been kicked out of the Wisconsin Evangelical Synod. Thank God them, not us. Because the congregations refused to endorse language saying that only men should hold authority and that women should submit to them. The document at the center of the conflict, which outlines the roles of men and women, says these roles apply beyond the marriage relationship. So it's not just your husband we're talking about here. We're talking any man. It also says that women cannot teach men and that, only, quote, only men will do work that involves authority over men. And the whole conflict came up in this parish because a woman had a job where she was the boss of a lot of people, hiring and firing, and a bunch of them were men. And she said, am I sinning? And then they started doing an investigation and thinking and reading in the Bible and studying together as a parish and three pastors in the parish. And they got so upset by what they were finding in their study that they pursued the question publicly. They had public forums in their church. For 3 years, the pastors of St. James Evangelical Lutheran Church have openly grappled with the doctrine. Synod leaders removed them from the church in May. Given a choice between firing their pastors or being removed from the synod, the congregation voted overwhelmingly Sunday to leave the synod. Three people dissented. And so then the pastors go on and talk about it, and they say, that their conflict, women aren't allowed to vote in church elections, much less be ordained ministers. In this climate of not questioning authority, it's very rare for the synod to have to tell a church to leave, Lutheran officials said. I remember a number of congregations leaving our synod over a doctrinal issue some 30 years ago, said Reverend Ronald Ulhorn, vice president of the Minnesota District of the Synod. Since then, I don't recall anyone leaving over doctrinal issues in our district at all. St. James members began to question the document called the Scriptural Principles of Man and Woman Roles more than 3 years ago, said Stadler. In correspondence with the synod, they asked where the Bible specifically says that man must be the head and women must be submissive to man. They also introduced unsuccessfully resolutions at synod conventions asking that the document be reexamined. And it goes on and on. It's an interesting article. But I just thought that we should both thank Fred for his Bible study this morning, in which I think these issues came up, and tie in this 19th century story, and then remember that our roots go deep in this stuff. This is not notions about the appropriate role for men and women and for daughters and for sons are things that we didn't just get last week or 20 years ago. It's stuff that we've been dealing with for a long time, and I think we need to take seriously that tradition. I would like to ask a question, a couple of questions, before I read the story and talk, and we can talk about these questions from the point of view of the story. This story is about a Norwegian family at the turn of the century with two grown daughters living at home and what happens with them. I'm interested to know how best, what you immediately think of when you think of how best to love children who are your own or who you're responsible for, children you're raising. What are some of your responses of some of the central notions you have about loving your kids? What does it mean to love our children?
Well, I mean, I think they need a little discipline. You can't go through life doing just what you want to do.
Thank you. Discipline. And that, of course, is work.
It's work.
It's not so easy to be consistently firm about things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have five children, and I began, one of the first things I did was toilet training, with the idea that they were responsible for their own, that they were going to leave me, that I wasn't going to be doing diapers for a long, long time, that they were going to be independent. And my main emphasis in their schoolwork, when they came home with a paper that had some problems, I said, but do you understand now? My idea was that they need to be independent, they need to learn from their experiences. So it was pushing them away, and yet loving them a lot.
That's an interesting and wonderful set of concepts, the kind of push-pull.
Yeah.
And that's a tension within us, I think, as parents and as children. I still have living parents, and I still am their child in some ways, and I think I'm still in that push-pull. Bob?
I think one of the things that's central is safety, and I think that ties in with what Fred was talking about this morning. And the idea nowadays that, as a male, to think that your daughter is going to have to live with somebody she doesn't want to, or maybe unhappy with another man, can kind of make you physically sick. Thinking about it. I think you feel protected and you want to keep them safe when they're young. But I think also parenthood involves making sure that your daughter is safe even after she's married. That's something that's changed.
Mm-hmm. And maybe that's a stronger feeling we would have for our children than for our other loved people in our lives. We obviously want all of our loved ones to be safe, but I think because we feel this strong protective thing about babies and small children, it's stronger about them. When I was on the birthing bed, in the case of my two children, I had overwhelmingly strong feelings in reaction to finding out their gender. With my daughter, I immediately worried about rape. I wanted to protect this newborn infant, seconds old, from rape. And with my son, I immediately wanted to protect him from having to go to war. And felt very, I mean, it came unbidden out of my subconscious somewhere, these feelings of fear that this boy would be sent into the battlefields. So there is some very deep stuff about protection in us. What are some other reactions to sort of the central thing about raising kids or being a child in relation to parents that you could have?
I guess I just wish I had listened more and worried less about raising them.
You want to say more about that?
Well, I guess it was hard bringing, you know, parsonage into the church when I thought everything could be just so. And I think I just didn't listen so well. And I've seen so many people raise their children. Some were very nonchalant about it, and their children, well, they weren't so particular, and they all grew up as long as they loved them. You listen to them and love them, they grew up.
Listening and loving them. But you brought another third thing, interesting point, into the mix here, and that is raising them in the parsonage next to the church. So then you're so aware of the force of the community and the expectations, and what do other people think? What is society saying? What is our culture saying? What is our community saying? We were, you know, I'm 51, when I was a kid, we talked about the PKs, the preacher's kids, because either they were so well-behaved and tidy and groomed and wore their socks were always white and pulled up, or they were rebellious, and some of the wild kids of the community.
It used to be important to me to help my boys honor their own strengths, you know, to compliment them and to cheer each other on and love each other for their individual strengths.
So to live into their strengths and not decide for them what those should be or were, but to discern them, help them discern them and strengthen them and live into them.
Well, I had a way of deciding for them from time to time. But ideally, it would have been what they wanted.
It's frustrating to decide for your kid what you think their strengths are and then find that the kid doesn't agree.
Yeah.
How dare they? I've known them since they were born. Any other comments about this?
It seems to me, along with that, I mean, I was a school teacher, I don't have children, but you can always tell on Parents' Night, you know, what parents think are their kids' strengths, and sometimes they're not. So, I mean, it seems to me that the educational part of upbringing is a really important part. It doesn't necessarily have all to do with the school, but clearly kids need to be, an educational experience or life, and through that, you do learn something about what they're good at.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or what they're not good at, and so you don't push in that direction.
But it's interesting that none of us are talking about the inherited gender roles.
Yeah.
None of us are saying, well, I want my girls to be school teachers or secretaries, and I want my boys to be athletes or accountants or whatever we would sort that out. So we're not saying that we are, as a group of people, very determined by the gender of our kids. What do you think about that? Are we more than we're... maybe it's because the way I asked the question, I asked what the central things were, and we think those are secondary. Do you think that gender stuff is a real determinant now in how we raise kids, how we were raised?
I want my two boys to be able to make good decisions for themselves. And it's a constant challenge for me to know which in which area or a particular moment should I encourage them to decide for themselves, and let them experience the consequences of their actions. I found in issues that don't involve safety, they learn more, they take more from their experience and the consequences of their action. If they've made that decision, then I'll come back and ask them, and they reflect on it, and then they draw the conclusion. It's a challenge, though, to know at what stage they're ready to make their own decision about, in this area.
One of the strongest negative reactions I ever got to some of my parenting was, I teach college kids and I have them over now and then for potlucks and talent shows. And one of those nights, my 2-year-old boy and 5-year-old girl were playing, and my 2-year-old boy had on, he might have been only one because he was toilet trained pretty early, but he had on his diapers and Oshkosh train overalls and a t-shirt and a tutu over the overalls and diaper. And his older sister, who he admired and loved, had on her tutu. And, you know, they... So he was sort of lumbering. He was a big kid, and he sort of lumbering around in his tutu and his everything. Boy, did my college students get upset. They thought I was ruining this child for life, being too ambiguous about his gender, and, you know. So I wonder whether we have some strict, I mean, it was probably would have been okay with him if she had been in Oshkosh train man overalls, and, you know, but not that he would have been in her cast-off pink tutu.
It's not easy for young folks, what never was, never will be, but my son and daughter-in-law were just really determined, just like many young parents are, more aware of it certainly than we were in my generation, of making sure that you didn't give the truck to the boy, that the truck was available, that you didn't give the doll to the girl. I mean, this was talked about before the babies even arrived. And so, of course, the babies arrive, and then they're being very careful about this. And, of course, the little boy always plays with the truck, and the little boy always loves the loud machinery, and the little girl always wanted to wear the little dress. And, you know, it's almost like, what are you doing wrong? So you've got to be careful. You don't go too far. And obviously, they were just fine about it. But little people are born with certain things in their heads. And we parents and grandparents have got to be careful that you let them be who they are and do the affirming and not think that you're doing something wrong when they do what in the old days was called the stereotype.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you got to let go of your own political agenda or whatever.
You're not politically correct.
Yeah, right.
Well, in our family, boys, my parents were... Boys were of value, and I had 3 sisters, and we tried very hard to be my father's sons. And my darkest moment of my childhood was when my father said, "You hold that hammer like a goddamn girl." Mm-hmm. And it wasn't real. Mm-hmm. But now I don't choke up on that hammer, friends. I hold that hammer.
Mm-hmm. You learned.
Yeah.
Too bad that you were put down in that way.
Mm-hmm.
We did a lot of consciousness raising in our family among our kids, and finally what my kids, I always, when we were watching a movie or a show on television, would point out the sexist patterns that were going on, and we know, Mom, that was sexist, you know, sort of, give me a break. We've learned the lesson. So, well, I'm going to tell you a couple of things about this story that I'd like to read. It's called A Crime. It's by Nini Roll Anker, who was a Norwegian woman who lived from 1873 to 1942. I'm going to read you a couple things about her. At the time Nini Roll Anker was beginning her career as an author, Norwegian women were campaigning for the right to vote. The time had come for women to expand their sphere of activity to include social concerns, a challenge Anger took up in her many novels and short stories. She exposed injustice and urged reform. And then it goes on to talk about her particular works and her interest in working women and her interest in pacifism. And then it says, the main character in A Crime is a woman who appears only as a memory. In characteristic fashion, the author's criticism is indirect, but her indignation is unmistakable. It does not say which year she wrote the story, so I don't know that. But a few things to watch for as you're listening. I always think when you're listening to a story, it's maybe a little helpful since it's your one time through it. If you have a few ideas of what to listen for. Since the title of it is A Crime, I want you to think about what was the crime that was committed and who committed it. Because I think depending on who you are listening, you could answer that question different ways. What does the narrator think about the way these girls are treated? And I put quotes around the word girls. The girls are Elise and Anna. Elise is sometimes called Lisa in the book, in the story. And as far as I can figure out, Elise is 30 years old and Anna is 40. Mrs. Landsrud is only called Mrs. We don't know her first name. And Torvald is the father. I would like you to think about what is the underlying principle of parenting that has brought them to the place where they are now, and is there something attractive about that principle of parenting? Is there some good that was the impetus to bring them to the place where they are now in this family, in terms of how to raise kids? I think that there's an ongoing dialogue in the story between order and chaos, and order and chaos don't necessarily reflect good and evil. I think that they're, in this story, it's complex enough that good and evil or difficulty can be in both order and in chaos. And so it'd be interesting to kind of figure out how that balances out in what you hear in terms of creativity and life and death. And the relationship of those things to order and chaos. Does order represent something? The role of the church in these early Norwegian stories, the role of the church is always very important. I think the author is particularly gifted in details and imagery, vivid imagery, so listen just for the pleasure of it to that. Try to think about what, when the word happy and happiness is used, what is meant by this? It's used, whose happiness is being talked about, and what represents happiness? What does happiness mean? Then I would ask you to think about Torvald Landsrud. Is this character of Torvald a complex character or a simple character? Is he flat? Is he only one thing? Or does he have contradictions within him, and is he a deeper and richer character than that? So with those comments, I think I will read you the story, and then we can talk both about the story and what we can learn about the story about our own work as children and as parents. A Crime. I stopped by the day after the funeral. I felt it was my duty. We've known each other since childhood, Torvald Landsrud and I, and soon we'll have worked in the same office for 25 years. I was also Elise's godfather, though I paid little enough attention to her while she lived, I'm ashamed to admit. Landsrud has a way of keeping people at a distance. Not obviously, but at a distance all the same. I've often wondered exactly what it is that keeps us at arm's length from him. He's just a little fellow, not much to look at, unremarkable, you might say. But there's something about him just the same. Frankly, the people in the office are afraid of him. What is there about him? There he sits in his glass cage, taking in money, paying out money, orderly in the extreme. He'll return an account for the least error in spelling. One small letter has toppled greater men than I, he says. And it's true, isn't it? We have to give him credit, don't we? A precise and conscientious man, starched collar in place, well-groomed white beard, polite, kind to everyone. Yes, but just the same. I don't know if it's the soft voice or the nose that is clearly too small. I've actually brooded over it many times. I think it must be the eyes. Clear, blue, unblinking, expressionless eyes. I've tried to meet that gaze. I have nothing to hide, but I can never look him straight in the eye. I break out in a sweat. I just can't do it. He's so damned spotless, Landsrud is, you see, and he knows it. There's never been any talk about him or his wife or their two daughters. There's never been any gossip about any of them before this thing happened to Elise. So you can imagine, I'm a callous old bachelor. But the day I heard about Elise, I felt sorry for Landsrud and his family and his free church flock. You know how people are. Bank teller Landsrud doesn't belong to the state church. He's been an elder in his free church for many years. For my part, I prefer to listen to the bishop when I need bolstering. To my way of thinking, if it's going to be, let it be straight from the top, and surely the bishop is closest to our Lord. Bear that in mind, Judith. But Landsrud has gone his own way, and people have the gall to remember that, too, when misfortune strikes a man. Well, I put on my mourning gloves and went over the day after the funeral. I felt it was my duty to show Landsrud that I was his comrade in sorrow. The Landsrud have a nice home. I'd been there two or three times before. There aren't many who can say that. The Landsruds kept to themselves. They're self-sufficient folk, rare enough in our day. Anna once went to the sanatorium for her lungs. But that's a great many years ago. It must be almost 20 years now, and she's never been anywhere else that I know of. And there was never anything wrong with Elise. Elise has been at home with her parents her entire life. When she spoke, it was like listening to Landsrud himself, though for the most part she didn't have much to say. A nice, quiet girl, you know. Earned her 200 kroner a month at Hjortdals. I've bought ties and such from her many times. She clerked, exactly like a machine. Never any foolishness there. No glances and curls and head tilted at an angle. It was clerk and customer to everyone, prim and proper. She wasn't Torvald Landsrud's daughter for nothing. Both she and Anna lived at home and paid for their room and board. Everything was up to snuff in that household, regular household help. It could even be called ample under the circumstances. But with the accounts in order, you can be sure. Landsrud is not one to hand out pennies before he has squeezed them. What can I say? What can I say? A nice home, nice furniture, clean and tidy. Embroidery wherever one looked, and three women to look after it all. Well, there were three before Elise died. I'll never forget that morning, 2 weeks ago today, when I opened the office door and the bookkeeper came rushing up to me asking, "Have you heard the news, Jensen?" What could I have heard? I sat at home all evening, went to bed at 10 o'clock and slept tolerably well, shaved and ate breakfast in the morning and went to the office without speaking to a soul. "Elise Landsrud has disappeared," said the bookkeeper. "Disappeared?" I asked. "She was going for a walk in the storm yesterday. That's what she said, at any rate. And no one has seen her since. Now they're out searching for her. Landsrud." "A minute ago, my wife called and said they found her hat on Cropstead's dock." I was speechless. Elise, I thought. I could see her as clearly as I had seen her the last time I bought some small item at Hjortdal's. the small, thin mouth that never curved upward in a smile, the sharp nose and the black eyes. Her mother has black eyes. She wasn't pretty. Beauty doesn't run in the family, but she was a nice, quiet girl. From that home, too. It was inconceivable. Well, they found her later on in the day, as you know. Her body lay in shallow water. There was an onshore breeze, and the tide had done its work. She lay smiling. Inconceivable. Or? As I said, I went to Landsrud's after the funeral. The deceased godfather, it was my duty. The three of them were sitting in that lovely parlor. It must have been around 6 o'clock. They stood up when I came in. Black morning clothes in a nice room. It was a sad sight. Both Landsrud and his wife thanked me for coming. Anna sat locked within herself. Anna might well have thought she would go first, she who was the eldest. But no one knows what she thought. She and Elise had shared a room since they were little girls, and though there were 10 years between them, they had grown more and more alike. Elise celebrated her 30th birthday the day before she disappeared. Landsrud appeared the same as always, and I couldn't look him in the eye now either when he looked at me. "You've heard what they're saying?" he asked before I had a chance to sit down. I had heard so many things. People can't say enough on such occasions. "I never listened to Luce talk, you know that," I answered. "No, not you," he said, "but there's an abundance of those who do. An occurrence such as this is a good mouthful and a real treat for the mob. They can fall upon a decent man and a happy home for their own pleasure, Jensen. Their imagination knows no bounds." Landsrud talks this way, pedantically. He is an elder in his church. My chair began suddenly to feel hard and uncomfortable. I had come to bring condolences and had intended to leave again right away. Landsrud began to pace around the table. His head was thrown back, as was his custom, as if to make him appear taller. His hands were clasped behind his back. His whiskers were freshly trimmed, so you could see the skin underneath. It was as white as his beard. Mrs. Landsrud had obviously failed. She sat wringing her hands. Anna crocheted. "The police have been here," Landsrud said. "Are we to be spared nothing? We have been questioned. The rumors have done their work. We were asked if there was a man in Elisa's life." In Elisa's life, Jensen. In my daughter's life. They questioned Anna, too. Anna immediately bent her head. She mumbled something. I couldn't hear what it was. Landsrud asked if I could imagine a man in Elisa's life. I had to answer as I saw it. I couldn't imagine it. I was satisfied that I could truthfully say that, to his comfort. Landsrud didn't raise his voice. He never raises his voice, but I could see that he was shaken and upset. I could see it by the trembling in his beard. "There, you heard it, Anna. You heard what Elisa's godfather says, so you should have answered also," he said in his customary mild tone. I said the truth. I answered, "Not as far as I know." Anna also spoke quietly. Landsrud knocked on the table with his ring. "But we do know it," he said. "And you shouldn't exaggerate your truthfulness, Anna. A man? Where would he have come from?" Elise went to the store at 9:10. At precisely 2 o'clock, she hurried home by way of Storgatan and ate her dinner. "And you sat with her, mother?" "Every day," mumbled Mrs. Landsrud. "She took Storgatan back and worked until closing time. After supper, she took a walk around the hospital for her headache, on well-lighted streets, when we weren't in church. Where would a man come from? I've kept my little girls close to home, and the whole town knows it." I had to agree with that. "Do you know of any reason your daughter would take her own life?" they asked me. She didn't commit suicide, Jensen. Why ever would Lisa want to do away with herself? He didn't shout, but his voice shook. We're happy and well contented, he said. We've always been happy. Between these walls fall no hard words. Here rules peace and harmony. Here is a home our Lord and I have provided for that. Mrs. Landsrud looked up. It was the first time she had looked up since I came into the room. I have brooded over this visit, you see. I have recalled every moment. I am not mistaken. She looked up for the first time. She did not look at her husband. She looked at me. She has dark eyes, dark and small, and not easy to read. It seemed to me that her eyes begged for forgiveness, begged my forgiveness for something. But that is an impossible idea. It was a strange look. A crime has been committed, said Landsrud quietly and slowly. It will probably never be solved, Jensen. Our police chief is a drunkard. Come now, drunkard? That's a strong word, Landsrud, I said. I've seen for myself how much beer is carried into that house, he answered. We see it from our window every day, as you well know. Yes, naturally. I've seen the beer wagon from the office window as well, but I'm very nearsighted, and unfortunately there's a lot that I miss. Landsrud told me that Anna had seen the police chief come staggering from the club many times. You remember we've talked about it, Anna, he said. Yes, Papa, Anna answered. You remember you saw it, he asked. He wasn't steady, Anna said. There was nothing I could say. I'm an old sinner myself. The police chief won't investigate, said Landsrud. Elise has been the victim of a criminal, but now she is with God. He has taken her to him, and he alone knows how she came to him. Mrs. Landsrud folded her hands. Her tears fell on them. I wanted to get up. I didn't feel well, but Landsrud laid his hand on my shoulder and said, if you had only been here that last evening, Jensen, if you had heard Elise say, now I am 30 years and one day old. If you could have smelled the sweet, fragrant spices from the stove and cast an eye over our little circle, you would understand that no one would desert this home of their own free will. Anna laid down her crochet work. She got up, crossed the room, and opened the stove door to put a piece of wood in the stove. The red light from the glowing coals reflected on her face, a closed-in face, as I said before. Suddenly, Mrs. Landsrud spoke. Or possibly she was just thinking out loud. It seemed a feeble cry from one long silent. It took me by surprise. We sat, all three of us, around the table, she said. Papa wandered around with his pipe. We talked about the Olsons down below who are never at peace. I've reported him, Mother, Landsrud said. It's the last time he'll use our garbage cans. I don't believe she heard a word of it. She sat and rocked. Her hands had become still. She recalled that last evening, just as I have gone through this visit in my mind. I could see it in her eyes. She just went on. And you remember, Anna, you said you had seen Netta Olson come home with a fellow again. And you remember they said they turned the phonograph on in the middle of the night. And Elise cried because she couldn't get to sleep. And then Elise said, I wasn't crying. And then you said you must have heard wrong. And then Papa said that a person ought to be able to weep over their sins without witnesses. And he asked Elise to fill his pipe, and she got up and filled his pipe. And I said, you should stuff cotton in your ears at night, little girls. Then you would sleep as well as ever. Do you remember, Anna? Anna didn't answer. She was about to begin her crochet work again, but Landsrud pointed to the tongs she had forgotten to hang up, and she got up and hung the tongs back on the rack. Her mother continued, and then for tea, we ate the rest of the cake that Elise had had for her birthday, and we lit as many of the 30 candles as were left and watched them burn one by one. And Lisa snuffed out the ends one by one with her spoon. Landsrud stood and looked at me. When I looked at him, he nodded. His head sat straight on his shoulders. His eyes were filled with tears. Mrs. Landsrud continued, "So then Papa sat down in the rocking chair and read through the newspaper, page by page, and we sat with our embroidery and listened to the rain on the windowpane. We didn't talk then because he was reading. When the church clock struck 9, Anna took out the deck of cards. We play double solitaire in the evenings, Anna and I," said Landsrud. "I'm no card player, Jensen. It's just a harmless pastime." "No, I know you don't play cards," I answered. Then his wife chimed in again. And when Anna took the tablecloth off the table, Elise said, "Roll it up the other way, just for once." Anna looked up. She turned red, but why should she blush? Her mother said, "But surely Anna had to roll up the tablecloth wrong side out, just as she's always done, didn't she, Jensen? It was just a whim on Lisa's part." Then Papa sat down at the table and they began to lay out the cards, and I sprinkled a few more spices on top of the stove, and Lisa said she wanted to go for a walk. Then I asked if she really wanted to go out in this awful weather, and she said she wasn't afraid of the rain, and I followed her out into the entry and saw to it that she put on her galoshes and raincoat. But I couldn't persuade her to take an umbrella. And then she left. When the poor woman had finished talking, it was as if she died. It was awful to see. I stood up. "Well, Jensen, now you've heard about our last evening with Elise," said Landsrud. "Can you imagine anything in this peaceful night that would make a young girl want to abandon this life?" I couldn't meet his eye. I bowed my head and said goodbye. Anna followed me to the door. When she had opened it for me, she came with me down the stairs, past the Olsen's apartment and out the front steps to the street. Then she took me by the arm and said, "For my part, I stopped crying at night a long time ago, and Elise would have too if only she had been patient. But when people say that Lisa was pregnant, then you can tell them from me, Mr. Jensen, that it is a dirty lie, for she drowned nobody but herself." I came down here to the club and had a good stiff whiskey and soda. I'm just telling what happened. But thoughts, they are a strange thing. I too have come to the conclusion that there was a criminal. And drinking doesn't shake that idea from my head. A good home, irreproachable, one might say. But when they found her, Elise was actually smiling. A mystery, yes, but one is free to ponder.
That's that.
Yeah, it is.
Does it say at the beginning, when they found the body, what she was wearing?
No.
Okay.
She was lying face up.
But does it say anything about clothing?
The raincoat and galoshes.
Yeah.
It says that her hat was left on the dock.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the hat isn't mentioned in when the mother dresses her 30-year-old daughter in a raincoat and galoshes. Well, what are your feelings?
Good story. It's a really nice piece of literature.
It is an excellent piece of literature, I think. How does it make you feel?
Repressed.
Trapped. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to get out.
Trapped.
Like those Norwegian writers must have been really tough in Norway, I suppose, other places. But Ibsen writes about women just like that. They just are so trying to do what's right. They've got all these rules, and it's so sad.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Doll's House is.
Yes.
It was beautifully put on television there a year ago. Just overwhelming, and it was fun for Dwayne and I to sit and watch because he hadn't read much of it. And it really comes across how rotten men have been within the rules of doing what they think is right.
You know, I thought was really interesting about this story is that it's a woman author and it's a male narrator.
Yeah.
That is not at all usual.
Right.
I mean, it took me by surprise.
Yeah.
I realized that the narrator was male.
Yes, I think that's interesting.
Is quite often.
He's a male narrator. What else do we know about him? Let's just get the narrator out.
He's a bachelor.
The godfather.
He
works for Lazarus, with Lazarus.
Uh-huh.
He's a self-proclaimed sinner.
He's a sinner. So immediately we like him.
Yeah.
He has got the rules too.
Uh-huh.
Well, and he does a wonderful job of sort of feeling that there's something wrong with this perfect family. Well, he doesn't ever come to conclusions, but he says that he's only been to visit three times, and that's more than anybody else can claim. Well, that's a really amazing isolation that he's described, especially in a Norwegian village where this would be a normal kind of thing to do. I mean, you don't have the cinema or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
What is this, 18-something?
Just about the turn of the century.
And
he also feels guilty, and he tells us very early on that he feels guilty that he didn't pay more attention to his godchild, but that he has purchased little stuff from her at the store many times. And he also tells us that he went and had a stiff drink after this visit, and that he occasionally has a drink.
I tell you, he did come to a conclusion at the end, and that was that a crime had been committed.
Yeah.
Yes.
I assume that when he said that, he believed that someone outside the family had committed the crime.
We should talk about that. What is?
I don't think someone outside the family did commit the crime, but from what he said in my reading, I assume.
What's the crime?
That he did.
What's the crime that you're thinking?
Well, the father just took all the life out of his daughter. He killed her before she was dead.
I think it was the whole family, actually.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, because the father was portrayed as the most domineering, but the sister and the mother still sat by and allowed it to happen.
Cushing.
But Anna was insistent. She said nothing, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did she say it twice?
She insisted that there could be some other nuance in the life of her sister.
She couldn't break herself, though, to turn the tablecloth the other way around. You know, that seems like that was maybe the straw that broke the camel's back. Just that one little thing. Couldn't you do one little thing differently?
And Elise also snuffing out the candles on her the day after her birthday. As they burn down. Bob, you've had your hand up.
There's clues throughout the story that Elise was pretty depressed. I mean, was crying at night, walking around the hospital grounds every day to get rid of her headache, dying with a smile on her face. And in that family, there was certainly no one to talk to in that family because everybody in the family thought everything was perfect. And in fact, and probably the whole town has no one to talk to. So there's no way out of it. There's no way to deal with her depression. The whole town thought the family was perfect. So that's one thing that struck me. The other thing that strikes me is that most of the time when someone commits suicide, the immediate family blames themselves. Here you have a situation where Lansrud considered himself the victim, and he considered himself victimized because there were rumors and stuff. He didn't feel guilty at all about her death. He felt himself the victim. That's what's kind of struck me.
So one crime would be the crime against Lansrud. Well, what on the literal level, what crime did Lansrud say had happened? Torvald Lansrud, what did he think was the crime?
Somebody had killed her.
Yeah.
Because he wanted the police to investigate.
Yeah. He said a crime has been committed. Mm-hmm. And he thinks the crime is that somebody murdered his daughter.
And he got off the doctor pregnancy, the mother, I guess.
Anna.
But
this is what's so sad, because it isn't that family who are committing the crime, which I agree is what you're just saying, that they, you read one sentence, I've kept my daughters in all the years. I mean, I thought, bingo, that's the crime. But it was the culture that was the crime. They didn't have any idea they had another option. It was just such a trap. It's such a tragedy. It didn't start to break up in Norway till people started to come to America, and they had immigration and a chance to get out of it. They were such a terribly class-structured society with all these rules and no way to break through.
And we had them in Moorhead, Minnesota when I was a child.
They came over. They brought them with them.
They brought them with them. We had a sense that card playing was sinful, and surely dancing was. We couldn't dance. And there were a lot of rules about how to do things that I was very conscious of, and to this day I'm conscious of when I go back there. Particularly I'm conscious of them when I go to anything at Trinity Church in Moorhead. That's where the rules seem to be the most intact in that setting. What were some of the images of orderliness and some of the ways that that family maintained order? What about order in the family? How did that work?
Well, she forgot to put the tongs back in her father.
She fills his pipe.
Reminded him with a glance.
With a glance. Yes, right.
And they don't talk till 9 o'clock because Papa's reading.
Yes, page by page, the newspaper.
And Anna has picked up, has become her father's daughter in the very way that she assesses things, like, not that we know of. We're not going to leap to conclusions, or we're not going to say that we don't know, or we're going to say not that we know. But there's kind of an accountant's.
Yeah, we're only going to say what we know for sure.
Yeah, there's this story about the accountant that says two accountants in the field, and said, what color is that cow over there? And the one guy says, it's brown on this side. Not that we know of. This sort of mathematical way of living life, just step by step, the same every day.
Well, Anna used to cry, but she doesn't anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's become her father's daughter.
And she thinks that if her sister had just lived long enough, she would have learned not to cry,
got
too.
Over it. Mm-hmm.
And the sister cried when she heard music, mm-hmm, from downstairs.
Yeah.
And then in the evening. Excuse me?
I wonder what will happen to Anna.
I think we can predict.
Just get older.
Mm-hmm. I wondered how the parent, Torvalds, got married and had kids. It seems like it's all sort of beyond the pale.
It seems like they all feel that having their daughters meet men would be the worst thing that could happen to them.
And since they are one, why? Yeah.
Almost then we could say that he must have, or his wife must have committed a sin in some way. How did they ever?
Right, and they agreed to have sex at least twice.
Yeah.
10 years apart.
But we don't know, these kind of stories bring up family stories, relatives, ghosts in my closet or whatever. But I had an aunt and an uncle who sound like these people. And Cynthia, my cousin, my age, we'd have Thanksgiving together. And Uncle Merton was very worried about money. He was an attorney and had plenty of it with GE. But it was just I have a lot of stories about how they worried about money. And when Cynthia got a suitor, can you guess what happened? She actually got engaged to this suitor, but Uncle Merton was sure the suitor was after the money. I mean, this is a true sad story. Wedding invitations are out, and they canceled the wedding. And my Cynthia cousin stayed home and took care of her mother and kind of went crazy. She visited me afterwards, and she was a mentally ill lady.
And there's probably, and everything is in place in that home. Sitting and doing the women doing, what handwork were they doing?
Crocheting,
which I think is orderly and imposing order and repeated patterns and tidy and then they played solitaire, which is
non-communicative
and double solitaire side by side, but setting cards from chaos into four piles of. Orderly in numbers, restoring the cards to their order. They begin that at 9 o'clock when the church bell rings. You had a sense that there was never anything out of place in that house, and that that it was all everything had been decided, and there were a few little things that were. Nuances. The mother got up and threw more spice on the stove. Did you? And the stove smelled of spices when you walked in. I mean, the house smelled. So she did what she could to make it something different happen there. Some nice smell, which I thought was nice.
She apparently knew something was wrong. By her eye contact with Jensen.
That whole scene when she looks up at Jensen seems very important. Remember how she... Yeah, and she looks guilty, and she looks like she's pleading for something.
Well, she is the one that, feels responsible after the bringing of the hands and crying onto her hands.
Crying onto her hands, yeah. That was nice. Where is the place?
Ask for forgiveness with her eyes.
Yeah. Mrs. Landrude looked up. It was the first time she had looked up since I came into the room. I have brooded over this visit, you see. I have recalled every moment. I am not mistaken. She looked up for the first time. And the line before that is, but his voice is shaking. He didn't shout, but his voice shook. We're happy and well contented, he said. We've always been happy. Between these walls fall no hard words. Here rules peace and harmony. Here is a home, and the home is in italics. Our Lord and I have provided that. And that's the speech that makes her look up. And then she looks up and says, she did not look at her husband. She looked at me. She has dark eyes, dark and small, and not easy to read. It seemed to me that her eyes begged for forgiveness, begged my forgiveness for something. But that is an impossible idea. It was a strange look. So she felt something there. She really did have some sense that she shared some knowledge with the narrator, that together they both understood a different thing than what was happening.